This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Michigan State University President Luana Simon resigned last night amid the fallout from the Larry Nassar sexual abuse scandal. Yesterday, before that news broke, I spoke with public relations professional Rick Chambers, the owner and president of Rick Chambers & Associates in Kalamazoo, about crisis communication. That interview is coming up. But first, stories of sexual harassment have come from many different places and professions. The Gongwer News Service recently found that female lawmakers and staff at the state capitol have been subjected to sexually charged comments. Gongwer staff writer Alethea Caspin joins us from the Michigan Public Radio Network studios in Lansing. Hello, Alethea.
Hey, Gordon.
So let's begin with the origins of this story. Were you just kind of looking into what was happening at the Capitol, or had you heard some specific stories about what female lawmakers and staff were subjected to?
You know, anecdotally, I think most people covering the Capitol have heard either sexist comments, sexually inappropriate comments. We hear that that is happening to people. So that was definitely in the back of my mind as sexual harassment stories from industries around the country were starting to come up. And a lot of female lawmakers did post on Facebook and Twitter during the Me Too movement that they had been, maybe not at work, but had been subjected to either harassment or other types of misconduct. So that was part of the reason that we wanted to look into, you know, what's really happening in the Capitol.
Were there women who were reluctant to talk to you on the record, have their name put with the story out of fear of retaliation or something else?
Yeah, I think a lot of women are not super comfortable talking about what is happening at the Capitol. I talked to a lot of women anonymously, and you know, a lot of women also didn't get back to me if I called them about this story.
So how hard is it for someone who has been subjected to a series of comments, perhaps have been sexually harassed, to make a complaint to try to get some sort of resolution to that?
So each branch in the legislature, the Senate and the House, have business offices which handle their HR departments. So they can make complaints to either their direct supervisor or the business offices themselves. So it's not necessarily that it's difficult to make a complaint. It's more, I think, staff especially is concerned that something may not happen. There might not be any consequences for someone, particularly a lawmaker, if they are making inappropriate comments.
And State Senator Margaret O'Brien from this area spoke to you for this story and said that she's had a couple of times where male lawmakers or staff have said something to her she felt was inappropriate. She dealt with them. She didn't name anybody. She also said that she thought that the workplace environment for her as a woman in the legislature has improved. But she said it's difficult to know what it's like for staff. Do staff members and maybe the people around them feel that they're in a little different position?
Yeah. So Margaret, Senator O'Brien, she talked about how she dealt with the situation herself. I think when you look at female lawmakers, that is generally how they might deal with this. They go to their colleague and they say, that was inappropriate. Please don't say something like that again. And they move on. A staffer might not be as comfortable going up to an elected official who could potentially be their boss or a friend of their boss and say, you know, you should not say that to me. But they also don't feel comfortable generally going to make a complaint. So a lot of times, if it's against a staffer, this is just going going unreported. And they don't feel comfortable because the business offices are working at the pleasure of the speaker or the Senate majority leader. They think that politics is involved. They don't see a path toward real consequences if it is a lawmaker making these statements.
Is there anything being done right now to address that, or is there at least some talk of trying to reform the process and perhaps make sure that it's a little more comfortable for someone to come forward?
Yeah, generally, both business offices, I think, are taking this seriously even before my story, but just with what is going on around the country, looking at their sexual harassment policies and how they can improve their training. And at the same time, the Women's Progressive Caucus in the House has sent a letter to the House Business Office talking about different changes that they think need to be made. One of those being having some sort of third-party person who staff members could talk to that maybe at least appears more removed from the political structure of the House. The problem with that is no matter how you look at it, the House is still going to be paying that person. They're still going to be hiring that person. It is hard to get a completely separate entity to handle this.
Your story lists some of the things which might contribute to this, the culture of the state legislature, working long hours, mostly men as elected officials, parties and dinners with plenty of drinking. Focusing on that middle one there for a moment, this is still an area, the state capitol, where it is mostly men who work there, right? Not only as lawmakers, but on staff?
Yeah, so particularly with lawmakers in the Senate, we have 38 senators. Four of them are women. And in the House, we have 109 right now, normally 110. And a little more than 30 are women. Staff, you know, is a little bit more diverse. I think there is some more women on staff, but men are generally in roles of leadership and are running the show, so to speak.
Is there some sort of record that shows that at some point some male lawmaker has, behaved inappropriately and has been sanctioned in some way for it? Has that happened?
It has not happened on record. It has not happened in a way that I could find for this story.
You also noted a couple of specific allegations and actually reached out to some of the male lawmakers who were accused. Did any of them own up here and say that maybe at some point they did do something that was not appropriate?
No one admitted to saying anything inappropriate. I did have two former representatives, Sarah Roberts, a Democrat from Macomb County, and Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat from Detroit, and both of them made allegations against lawmakers who they did name, Senator David Kinesic, former Rep. Paul Clemente, and Representative John Bumstead, who Representative Roberts did say she said she filed a complaint against a Republican lawmaker, and I later confirmed it was former Rep. Bumstead. And both Representative Bumstead and Senator Kinesic, you know, denied doing anything.
In the case of Senator Kinesic, he did not actually talk to you, right?
He did not. He responded through a spokesperson who called the allegations ridiculous and baseless.
Going back to some of the culture at the state capitol, how much does alcohol play a factor here? Are people often in situations where, you know, there might be an open bar and perhaps somebody has a little too much to drink and then, you know, inhibitions are lowered and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think the fundraisers, the parties, going out with alcohol involved, that definitely helps blur the line here where people don't necessarily know what's appropriate. And from my reporting, I heard, you know, the parties where there was alcohol going out after session or going to fundraisers, that's where you started to hear, oh, this happened to so-and-so, you know, this person said this to another staffer.
And the long hours, are people perhaps spending enough time with each other that someone gets the idea that they're a little too, I don't know, maybe they're more comfortable than they should be around a female lawmaker or a female staff member, that they can say something that they, you know, might say to somebody, who they know better, a close friend, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a very unique work environment. You have sessions that can run, you know, 24 hours working overnight. You feel this sort of team loyalty also. So staffers might, you know, they go out to dinner with these people. They're texting all the time. It's not like a typical work environment in the private sector. When I talked to Senator O'Brien, she mentioned that too. And she said, you know, there's just an over familiarity with among staffers and lawmakers. And, you know, what she said, which I think really got to the point, is it is a unique work environment, but it is still a work environment.
That can't be lost in all of this. There's still a level of professionalism that should be maintained no matter how comfortable people feel around each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have a note on this story where you ask people who might have been harassed at the state capitol to get in contact with Gongwer. Are you hoping that you can do more on this?
I am. I think that there are a lot more stories out there. I think that there are potentially worse stories than what I wrote about. I wrote about some inappropriate comments. I think there could be more going on that is either worse or more consistent. There could be people who make comments often and could be a problem that needs to be fixed.
One of the things we have seen with the Me Too movement is once a couple of stories come out, other people do come forward and say, yes, I've had similar experiences. Do you think that maybe we are just at the beginning with the state capitol in terms of perhaps we're hearing just the first couple stories and that more may be coming soon?
Possibly. I think people might be more willing to speak when they see two former representatives speaking on the record. But, you know, also House and Senate business offices are working at fixing this, or at least trying to make their policies stronger. So it could also be a possibility that people want to see if the system can work itself out.
Did you get the sense from people in leadership that they are looking at this, taking it seriously, that they've heard enough stories themselves that they think something needs to be done?
I did not reach out to legislative leadership, but certainly the business offices are taking it amongst themselves to look at this and improve their policies, which they do have to have some level of okay from legislative leadership.
What's your big takeaway from this, Alethea? As you talk to these people, you hear their stories, and then you also talk to some of the people who've been accused. What would you kind of say is the big lead on this, if you were going to try to put it that way?
Just that this is happening and inappropriate comments are being made, inappropriate behavior is happening more often than I think most people would expect in the Capitol.
Alethea, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Gordon.
Alethea Caspin is a staff writer for the Gongwer News Service. She joined us from the Michigan Public Radio Network studios in Lansing. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Public relations professional Rick Chambers shared some thoughts recently on the scandal at Michigan State University involving former sports doctor Larry Nassar. Chambers, who is owner and president of Rick Chambers Associates, wrote about MSU's response in a blog post called Past Time to Start the Healing. I spoke with Rick Chambers yesterday before MSU president Luana Simon announced her resignation. Thank you for being here, Rick.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So let's kind of start off broadly speaking about what we have come to known as crisis communications. You have been at times on the other side from people like me in the media who want to know what's happening with a situation where maybe you don't have the best news to pass on. How do you deal with that? What's the best way to tell the public and the media something that you know the public may not receive gladly?
So I think a lot of times there's the impression that in a crisis communication situation that the public relations person's job is to only, try to obscure the facts and not be, transparent in what's going on. And that's absolutely not the case. The really underlying thing that goes with crisis communications is really accountability, what I call, when I talk to my clients, owning the ugly. Right. There's in a crisis situation, there's always going to be ugly. And so own it and say, this is what's going on. And that's where transparency really becomes a key element of it. So this is what the ugly is. And we understand, again, empathy is another piece that's extraordinarily important, making sure that you understand and reflect the fact that people are impacted by this crisis and acknowledging that. So owning the ugly, being transparent about it, expressing that empathy, and then showing here's the actions that we're going to take and making sure that you're constantly updating people on the progress of that so that they know what's going on. And that gives them a sense of comfort and understanding and the opportunity to ask the questions that they may have.
There is a word that gets associated with PR that you don't like, spin. Explain why you don't like the word spin.
I despise the word spin. And I'm actually glad you asked that. It's interesting. I did an article for Reagan's PR Daily a while back talking about that's a word that public relations professionals need to expunge from their vocabulary. And I surprisingly got a lot of pushback on that. Where individuals were saying, actually, there was one commenter who said, if I'm not spinning for my client, then I'm not doing my job. And my argument was, if a client expects me to spin, then that's a client I don't want. Why? Because spinning is about distorting the truth. Public relations professionals should be the champions of truth. And so if I'm distorting the truth, then there's another word for that, and that word is lying. And so to my mind, spin and lying are synonymous. And so spin needs to go away. It needs to be about accountability. It needs to be about transparency. It needs to be about truth and action.
In that same article, you ask the question, is ethical PR possible? Is it?
Absolutely. Ethical PR, ethics and PR need to be intertwined. There's sort of that old-fashioned stereotype that PR people are the greasy-haired shysters that, from the old carnival days or something like that. But in reality, again, it's got to be about being champions of truth and being champions of what's right and knowing and understanding your audience and at times being champions for them with your client. Quite often a client will say, this is a message I need to deliver. For myself as a PR professional, I'd say, okay, this is what your audience is looking for, what your audience needs to hear. You need to understand that and at times adapt what it is you want to share so that your audience feels heard. We are sort of that conduit. One of the lessons that I learned early in my career actually was I was a student at Western Michigan University taking a public relations class with Dr. George Robeck. And I always remember this. We had a small group exercise where we had to put together a PR campaign for Tiger Cubs, part of the Boy Scouts of America. And we had a survey as part of that. And to make a long story short, the survey we were putting together as a means of essentially marketing Tiger Cubs to the audience. We weren't really using the survey to gather data and information and feedback from the parents. And Dr. Robeck called us on that. And I remember being upset about that. But he was saying, you're doing this survey under false pretenses. And I was upset because it hurt my grade. But as I reflected on it, I've never forgotten that lesson. He was absolutely right. I was not being a champion of truth in that moment. And that has really guided much of my career over the years.
Does a lot of this depend on the client you're working for? In other words, are there some clients out there who will want spin, who will want perhaps to obscure the truth, while others will hear what you say about integrity and honesty and say, yeah, that's what I want. I want the truthful PR. And some clients may not.
You know, it's interesting you ask that question. I'm grateful that all the clients that I work with are definitely all about integrity and truth and transparency, because if they weren't, I wouldn't work with them. Not long ago, I actually was approached by a potential client that I ended up not working with. And interestingly, from their standpoint, I don't think that they were, I wouldn't say that they were not interested in integrity in their PR person, but the business area they worked with is not one that really reflects my own sense of integrity and such. And so I affirm their right to be in business, it wasn't something that I was interested in doing. So the integrity has to go both ways. It's the integrity of the client, the truthfulness and transparency that they portray, but also the integrity of the public relations person and making sure that the clients that they're working with are reflective of their values.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. I'm speaking with public relations professional Rick Chambers about crisis management and how Michigan State University has handled the Larry Nassar sex abuse scandal. Our conversation was recorded yesterday before MSU President Luana Simon announced she's resigning. When there is an organization, a business or a university or any sort of other organization which has a problem, we remember hearing in Watergate that it wasn't so much the crime, it was the cover-up. Is the problem with something like Michigan State, the crime, of course, is awful, but had it been stopped at the first time somebody had a chance to stop it, it would be bad, but not the horrendous, horrific situation which we have come to now decades later.
Absolutely. And that's where the issue comes down, I think, where MSU is really has a problem right now. The fact that this went on for so long and that there are, as far as some of the investigative reporting that's been done, the investigations and so forth to date, that there were people that knew. And that for whatever reason, the systems that should have stopped it from happening early were not working. Who is responsible for those things down to individuals? I can't say, but I do know this is in the end of the day, it's about the senior leadership. And those systems were not the right systems. The right people did not take action in the way that they should have. And so the leadership has to be held accountable. The challenge that we've seen is that the leadership of MSU has not embraced that accountability. They've played at it, in my opinion, a few times. There's some words that they have thrown out there that were, in my sense, is basically words, but they haven't really owned the horrendous situation that this is. And that has caused a loss of trust among stakeholders. It's hurt their reputation. And it's certainly just simply not right. And they've compounded that by a profound lack of empathy for the victims of this horrendous crime that's taken place. And these women have been, their lives completely upended. It's just, it's horrible to even think about what they've endured and the healing that's going to have to take place. Instead, what we get is a lot of language around legal maneuvering, insensitive messaging. I even saw a quote from one of the trustees that was saying that, you know, there are other things going on in MSU, not just this Nassar thing, Joel Ferguson, and that this Nassar thing, quote unquote, is just a blip on the radar. MSU is going to wrestle with this for a very long time. And the sooner that they own it, the sooner that some people in senior leadership take the accountability and the actions that need to be taken, that's when the process of healing, as long as it will be, can begin.
As you and I were emailing back and forth setting up this interview, I shared with you a blog post from Zach Gorchow at the Gongwer News Service, and I'll try to link to this as well on the website. I think people would find it interesting. He notes that there's three words in a message that Luana Simon sent by email last week that explain in part what's going on here. MSU is entitled to and its insurers require that we will mount an appropriate defense of these cases is what Luana Simon wrote. Its insurers require. And what Zach Gorchow is pointing out here is that the fear among MSU brass appears to be that if the university were to immediately settle in these cases instead of mounting a defense, which always includes a motion to dismiss the case, which Michigan State's been criticized for, the university's insurers would walk away. MSU would have to rely on its own resources to pay settlements. This is a case where there's financial interests, and then there's what you're trying to do in terms of doing the right thing. When that clash, when those two things clash, what's the response of someone who might be the PR person in the room? Or what should it be?
Well, what it should be is that it's a no-brainer. The decision has to be about the people and not about the dollars. And that would be my counsel immediately. I'm not entirely convinced that MSU would not be able to find insurers anywhere in the wake of it because it's Michigan State University. But even if we accept that, is that the price to pay in order to dismiss these horrible things that have happened to literally hundreds of young women? In the end, the steps that are being taken are all about protecting MSU and not about the victims. And that's just wrong. It's just wrong. And that's where the loss of trust comes in, the loss of reputation. You've already got students and families who are saying, no, my child's not going to MSU. I'm not going to MSU. Because there's no trust. Because they're thinking, if something as horrific as this could happen for 20 years and leadership not have the systems in place to stop it, what else could be going on? I'm not suggesting something else is, but that's the question, and the question that then cannot be answered based on what's going on right now.
I want to note as well, we are speaking on Wednesday afternoon, and as we speak, the sentencing hearing for Larry Nassar is continuing, and today, being Wednesday, is the day that his sentence is expected to come down. So by the time people hear this, they may very well know what his sentence will be. You mentioned the remarks by Joel Ferguson made in a radio interview. He has since walked that back, tried to apologize for it. Friday night after Michigan State's basketball game, Tom Izzo was asked about this and gave kind of an odd answer at one point where he said he hoped that the right person had been convicted, almost sounding like he was questioning whether or not Larry Nassar was in fact guilty. He has since clarified his remarks and said that he did not mean to imply that. But it brings up an interesting situation for a place like Michigan State. There's a lot of people who can be seen as the voice of the university. Tom Izzo is more recognizable to people worldwide than Luann Assayamah is. Joel Ferguson doesn't actually work for Michigan State. He's elected to their board of trustees, supposed to be our representative as the citizens to Michigan State. But I suppose there's a situation here where there's a lot of people who can be seen as the face or the voice of the university. And if you're the person who's trying to, you know, run their PR department, could that be a problem?
Well, I think the problem is the fact that the message that MSU has embraced in all of this is the wrong message. And I think that what's happening is that's catching up with a lot of people who, I think in their hearts, again, I don't want to paint the MSU leadership as demons. They're not. Larry Nassar's the demon in this story. But I think in their hearts, they understand that the message they're delivering is not the right message. And that's where they keep running into this, these stumbling blocks. So again, this is where leadership needs to come back and say, we're not doing the right thing. We are not speaking the right language. How do we need to change? What decisions do we need to make? And I think it really has to start with some serious changes at the very top.
And you do say at the end of your blog post that MSU President Luann Assayamah should resign. Members of the Board of Trustees should exit as soon as feasibly possible. Now, of course, these are pretty big decisions here, removing a university president and then elected members of the Board of Trustees, two of whom who are up for election this year have said they will not run for re-election. But I guess I have to wonder if you're, again, the let's very hypothetically here, you're working for Michigan State, you're the head of media relations. And you believe that Luann Assayamah should resign, but she doesn't want to. And the members of the Board of Trustees come out with this statement where they say, we support her. One then later said that he dissented from that. These are big decisions. But I mean, as the PR professional, if they are truly going against what you think they should do, what's your job at that point?
That's a very good question. And the answer is a tough one, because it's easy for me to say hypothetically what I would do. It's something quite different if you're the PR professional who has a family that you have to provide for and, you know, home that you have to pay for and all that kind of stuff. But if it were me, I would resign and leave because I could not stand to continue to be a champion for a message that I think is just absolutely wrong.
Would people who run large organizations, be they corporations, universities, et cetera, would they be wise to sound out the people who are in charge of public relations, who many of whom, of course, come from journalism and then move into PR? But would they be wise to have them in the room for big decisions to at least hear them? You know, not necessarily that they get a veto, but at least you hear, you know, you realize when you say this, this is how it's going to sound. This is, you may say A, but people are actually going to hear X.
Absolutely. And through much of my career, I've had the opportunity to do that with some of the senior leadership. And this is the situation that we're dealing with and the messaging that goes with that. And, you know, I'm always able to say, is it true? Is it right? Does it reflect the integrity and the values of the organization? And there have been times where I pushed back in my career. I can think of one in particular, which I've probably couldn't really relay the details of, but I will say that it was a big deal. And I was one of perhaps two voices in the room that said, the discussion that we're having and the direction that we're going in terms of the decision is not the direction we need to go. And I'm pleased to say that direction was changed as a result of a couple of us speaking up on that. And again, not because we had unethical people in the room, but because in the face of a crisis, there was the, how do we fix this? And that's what we keep coming back to. You have to own the ugly, be accountable, own it. And then what do we do from here? That's the important thing is we own the ugly. We reflect and recognize the impact on real people in real ways. And then what are the actions we're going to take to mitigate this?
Rick Chambers is the owner and president of Rick Chambers and Associates in Kalamazoo. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The conversation with Rick Chambers was recorded yesterday before Michigan State University President Luana Simon announced her resignation. Since then, Chambers has added another blog post called How Not to Start the Healing. Links can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.